Okay, thanks everyone for coming out to our Veritas response panel. Tonight we are joined by Reverend Sally Hitchner, Jonathan Kanoke, Ilse Vampitius, did I get that right? And Kamar Wood. So hopefully a lot of you were there on Wednesday where we had the Veritas Forum for this year. And it was called The Social Networks, Friendship Community, and the Social Media Revolution. And we were joined by Professor of Theology, Professor of Evolutionary Anthropology, and a former marketing exec from Facebook, now with an online entertainment company named InView. And we were asking them three questions, primarily. What is friendship? What is community? Well, before now. What is friendship? What is community? How is social media affecting these? And what is the relevance of the Christian tradition? Hopefully they'll be online soon, so you'll be able to take a look at that further. I'm not going to go into what they said in the evening because we have four people here who are going to speak to us, focusing on one, maybe two aspects of what they found interesting, disagreed with, agreed with, or something new that they want to add to the conversation. The way we're going to do, we're just going to go through each four, and then we're going to open it straight out to the audience, and everyone can throw in their contribution or question back to the audience or just their insight from the Wednesday night. Our first speaker is, as I said, Reverend Sally Hitchner. Sally was going to be speaking at our first follow-up event, which was on Saturday at St. Michael's in Northgate. We were discussing fellowship, discipleship, and the social media revolution. But unfortunately, Broken Britain got the better of her, and some kids had stolen copper off the train tracks, so she didn't make it. But we're really happy that she could come to this instead to speak with us. Sally is a curate at St. John's in Ealing in London. Previously, she was assistant chaplain at St. Peter's College, and she was an assistant chaplain with the Oxford pastorate as well. So, Sally, thanks.
Thank you. Well, firstly, I should warn you that I'm more used to preaching than giving academic talks, so if you feel at the end of your heart surging within you and an urge to give your life to Facebook, then chemistry will be available to my left. Almost without noticing it, social media has taken the world over our world. It's gotten under our skin and into our very selves. For a growing percentage of us, social media has become part of the furniture of our lives, as familiar as a coffee table or the TV. For many under 30s, Facebook is no longer something that they just do. It's an extension of their very being. And yet we're still working out a roadmap, a code of ethics, a theological framework for this brave new world. In the next few minutes, I'd like to set out a very sketchy and probably oversimplified map of the ideological landscape of the World Wide Web. The internet generation, and social networking in particular, contain three main landmarks I can see, that can be seen from most of the vantage points in the terrain. Generosity, libertarianism, and empowerment or discipleship. Now, Wikipedia is a great example of this because you can see all three aspects of this from this standpoint. Wikipedia offers something for free. It undercuts the authority of academics and publishers. It enables ordinary people to shape knowledge together. Social media has seen the extreme of both utopian and dystopian reactions to these views. It's created unimaginable wealth, yet has inspired millions to work for nothing. It has challenged authority, yet has enabled regimes to spy and censor as never before. It has been blamed for creating a generation of screen addicts, and yet has opened up new horizons of knowledge and connections. These three aspects can be found in both the advantages and disadvantages in the very beginnings of the World Wide Web. Tim Berners-Lee, who's the person credited with creating much of what we now understand to be the World Wide Web's origins, and others who have founded the early stages were mostly just hobbyists who met together in conventions and shared freely their ideas with each other. And this was going quite well until a young Bill Gates appeared and tried to inspire people to charge for their work. And other companies came in and took this over, and this would have expanded exponentially to the point where, if it wasn't for monopoly legislation, the internet as we know it now could have become a Microsoft product. And this pattern of revolution and counter-revolution in these three areas repeats itself throughout the World Wide Web's short history. Social media, however, focuses this culture of generosity in a new way. Generosity has evolved into friendship. Mark Zuckerberg once famously said that we are moving towards a world where the default is social. Berners-Lee said that the web naturally leads to openness. It makes openness easy and closeness more difficult. A culture of generosity in this world is about sharing not just our ideas. And it's something that resonates for me with the words I find in 1 Thessalonians 2 verse 8, where the writer says that, that he loves these group of people so dearly that he shares with them not just the gospel, but their very lives. As many have commented on the triviality of social networking and sharing, but as the sharing is part of our primitive social grooming, as baboons sit and pick fleas off each other's bodies, which actually serves to bond the group to one another. So ordinary talk, which likewise bonds us to one another, is found in social networking. But our technology enables this to happen over great distances is truly not trivial. Today we offer our thoughts, our academic work, our funny stories, ourselves, not in formats that you have to buy, but for free, on websites. Of course, there is now an invading culture of those who use these free sites to generate money across advertising by advertising things that are not free. But the prevailing culture is still of self-giving. Some sites take this culture of generosity to a new level and seek to redefine our concepts, even of possessions. A great example of this is Street Bank, which was set up by a Christian in West London, Sam Stevens, who found himself in need of a hedge trimmer, but not really knowing his neighbours well enough to ask them. He created this site where you can off-pledge gifts to anyone who lives within a one-mile radius of your house. This could be a gift of Chinese cookery, learning how to cook Chinese, or it might be a power tool. And to date, Street Bank has over 8,000 participants and has an average of 150 acts of pure generosity every month. While there are those who wish to exploit it, social networking appears to generally bring out the best in the majority of ordinary people. Our next landmark, however, is even more complex: libertarianism. The web creates equal access. You don't need anyone's permission to set up a website or to visit one. And when you're on the web, there's no overarching governments creating rules or regulations. There's no centre and no controlling authority. It is the ultimate levelling. The web has a tendency to be against state control, the legal system, and traditional hierarchies. Perhaps the most potent example of this is we see in the uprisings that happened in Egypt and other places over the new year. Facebook and Twitter created rallying points for this. Social networking enabled individuals to see how many others shared their perspectives, enabled faster coordination of activity. It enabled getting reports of this activity out to the West and allowed memes, catchphrases, ideas, videos to be spread through thousands within minutes. One person who was quite key in this revolution, or this movement, was, I'm going to try and pronounce his name correctly, Wael Ghanem. He worked for Google in Dubai and created this website working at night, calling himself El Shahid, which in Arabic means the martyr. He aimed to be a rallying point, a centre for reports about police abuse and torture. One tech entrepreneur from Lebanon put it this way, that by calling himself the martyr, he was someone who could be your brother, he could be you, he could be your friend, he could be your friend who was brutally tortured, and he was talking to you, not to the admin. The culture within social networking is anti the admin. Of course, the internet isn't entirely on the side of the revolutionaries. The web opens up information to the bad guys too. Oppressive dictators used to have to torture people to find out what they've been doing and with whom. Now they just need to get on to the Facebook. Through YouTube, we are their security cameras. Through Facebook, we're handing over our diaries and address books. But even then, the worldwide community promotes libertarianism. There is this counter-revolution that counteracts even that. When the Egyptian government blocked Twitter and Facebook, hackers in the West gave their time freely, for free, to create safe ways around these blocks. There is, of course, a more sinister side to the libertarianism in the culture. The music industry estimates that over 95% of music downloaded online is done so illegally. And even within the strict definition of social networking sites, we find cultural cul-de-sacs and self-harm groups and fantasy groups which are, can be quite destructive for the members who are part of it. But alongside with this linking unusual groups, the web creates great potential for Christians to communicate with like-minded groups. It's no longer the big corporations, but the small-scale community groups that are trusted online. The large multinational organisations are scrambling to have a small-scale feel. You might remember there was a royal wedding spoof that came out through Twitter. It was circulated through Facebook. Sorry, it came out through YouTube. It was circulated through Facebook. It looked like a group of friends getting together to do a spoof of the royal wedding. It came out a few weeks before it. And it was based on a genuine group of friends who were very low-key and low-budget, had done a spoof in their actual wedding. And it was only at the very end that you see that T-Mobile flashes up and you realise that this is actually a very subtle advert that we all shared, well, I shared anyway, for T-Mobile. They had appeared to be small-scale. In order to compete in this libertarian online world, big businesses are having to think small, and this is good news for churches and small-scale charities. And this leads me to our final landmark in this sketch of the social media landscape, empowerment or democratisation. Within the rise of social networking, you now don't need to have to be a somebody to get an audience with a following. It wasn't so long ago that if you wanted to get your ideas out there, you had to approach a publishing company. There were only a few publishing companies in the world, so power was held in the hands of a relative few. Now anyone with an iPhone can get access, anyone with access to a computer can get instant access to vast audiences. And we do. User-generated content is the jargon for this phenomenon, and it's estimated that a fifth of all content on the web is created by amateurs. And this is heavily linked to the social networking sites, as this Facebook is their main distribution forum. Blogs have their place, but user-generated content is becoming more and more YouTube-based. Most churches have to catch on to this. And this is where we're finding that the masses aren't really interested in a lofty, well-written professional prose. They want to know about the funny thing that your kid did this morning. The masses want to feel like the person who made this could be their friend. But as with the libertarian value, there's also the negative, as with the other values, there is also a negative side to this deep, great empowerment. With all this empowerment, with everybody, where everyone is a somebody, can anyone be truly heard? Are we in effect giving megaphones to everyone and getting them to stand in the courtyard trying to have a dialogue? Are we creating what some commentators have described as the dialogue of the deaf? To help this phenomenon, we have the emergence of a new funnels of control appearing within social networking. The emergence of aggregation sites or web curators who act in the same way as museum curators, collecting ideas, labelling them, ordering them and presenting them in a way that they think is helpful to those who follow them. Some like the Huffington Post can be seen to be taking on more characteristics of traditional newspapers, while others, particularly those that are Facebook linked and based, can remain more fluid. And so we continue this cycle of revolution and counter-revolution in these three areas. Generosity is replaced by more subtle exploitation, that is replaced by more generosity. Libertarianism is replaced by the extreme state control and is in its turn circumvented by those with libertarian ideals. Empowerment is replaced by monopolies and then are circumvented by individuals gathering together. And the question is raised, is the internet just an amplification of human nature, the good, the bad and the ugly? Like all technologies, the internet is not a cure for human nature, it's an amplification of it. However much religious language Mark Zuckerberg throws out there, Facebook cannot sanctify us. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful about the internet. The web seems to be endlessly reinventing itself and placing so much power at the fingertips of those who use it, so that whenever one part of the web is closed down, colonised or controlled, the technology opens up new frontiers. No one can stop this, but we do need to take care of it. It's an extraordinary challenge and responsibility shared by all of us, but also an extraordinary opportunity. Thank you.
go straight to Kamal. Kamal was part of our committee for planning Veritas this year. Thank you, Kamal. And he's also an MSc in statistics, and he's from St. Vincent, and he enjoys his BlackBerry, which he was just looking at now.
And I'll help us without friends. All right, I'm just going to talk very briefly about the Christian obligations of social networking. I think mine is more of a response to Saturday than Wednesday. But I guess it also comes into what happened on Wednesday. And I think we generally spoke about the opportunities that social networking does as far as Christianity and mission go. I just wanted to speak very briefly about the obligations. All right, so I guess when we think about Christian obligations, sometimes we divide it into maybe three or so main areas, thought, word, and deed. I mean, you hear that in one of the popular prayers of repentance. So I was just thinking, you know, just let's set thought to the side for now, and I'd speak a bit about using Facebook in speech, and by speech would mean communication, and in act. Well, you know, most of Facebook is speech, so I guess I'll start with speech and see what goes there. Now, one of the quotations Jen used on Saturday was one by the current Pope, where he said, there exists a Christian way of communication which is honest and open, responsible and respectful of others. To proclaim the gospel through the new media means not only to insert expressly religious content into different media forms, but also to witness consistently in one's own digital profile and in the way one communicates choices, preference, and judgments that are fully consistent with the gospel. I think this is a really, it's a really nice and succinct sort of exhortation about how we ought to use social media. It's very, very general, though. So you get, firstly, something that says that what it isn't restricted to. So it's not restricted to, you know, having a Bible verse a day on Twitter or Facebook, or, you know, always publishing videos from a favorite pastor, although certainly that is included. And it really captures a lot of the essence of this, which is that we need to be honest and sincere in these things. You know, a lot of these things, we're representing ourselves to other people. And while they give us a lot of control over how we present ourselves to people, they raise the issue as to just how much control should we have over these things? How many things should we not try to hide in an effort to be sincere and to be honest with other people? And, you know, that's the sort of thing that comes in here. So, something that came up in our discussions with Veritas was that a big part of using things like Twitter and Facebook is that, as opposed to having conversations with people personally, which is what we characterize a lot of relationships as. It's as Sally said, where, you know, everyone has a megaphone. You put information out there, and people pull it or people take it. So it's up to you what you put there. And many times you don't know who's taking what and who they passed on to and things like that. So it's very, very important that you watch what you say, you watch what you post, you watch what you do. And it's because, you know, you're being a witness, not only of who you are, but of Christ. What I want to focus on in this is we've heard these things of what it isn't limited to, and we've heard general things from, like, that quotation from the Pope of, you know, what it should be. But are there any, like, explicit things? How do I phrase this? My question is basically, when is it appropriate or when is it necessary for us to use explicitly Christian things or explicitly religious content on social media? So we've heard on one hand that it's not the only way of expressing our faith. But at the same time, it makes me wonder, you know, but when is that what we need to do? When is it that being sincere and choosing links that would nudge people towards a Christian worldview and things like that are not enough, and then we need to come out and, you know, just say who we are? Is it, for example, on Facebook where there's an option to show your religion? Are we obligated to put Christian there, or Catholic, or Protestant, or something? Is putting on shore, is not filling all that option a form of denying Christ? Probably not. Maybe it's not as you know, as bad as denying Christ, but is it still a form of hiding? A form of not wanting to tell people who you really are? a form of thinking, you know, everything I say could just be subtle and there's never a need to be explicit. Just some questions. So that's just the brief bits on the saying. And then I have a very, very little bits on the doing. And this is from some conversations with friends. Is there a Christian way of, like, using these things? We have a lot of, in evangelical circles, we often talk about idols, you know, things that we set up in our lives, that we, it, what we do with them comes down to bowing down to them and worshipping them. And obviously, we have to be aware of this with just about everything we do, including social networking. It's just a question of, at what point can things like Facebook or Twitter become idols? At what point do we become so dependent upon them that even if we share, you know, even if we do everything I'm saying here with saying, even if we share the gospel frequently and we're not people to Christ, like it's still, you know, wrong in a sense. Well, on the other hand, since social networking gives us the opportunity to, you know, keep in contact with friends and to reach all sorts of people we couldn't reach, are there any obligations there that we wouldn't usually have? I mean, 100 years ago, when someone came to Oxford from America, he wouldn't see his parents or his friends maybe for a year or 2 years, and he couldn't help it. But now that we can help it, do we have an obligation to keep in contact with those friends? Do we have an obligation to love them from afar and to be there for them in what capacity we can here, you know, because we can do it? Or is it okay to, you know, not bother and let them, you know, let the natural course of things go along and people grow distant and then we forget about them? Yeah, and the final thing is in terms of how we use Facebook. We have this saying at home, some people call Facebook a macro book. Well, macro is a local term for somebody who spies on other people's business, who gossips, somebody who you know, is somebody just minds other people's business. I know, and obviously people use Facebook for that. It's not the only thing. I mean, I know I've used Facebook in that capacity before. It just makes you wonder, like, are there certain uses of these things that are just, that we really shouldn't be engaging in things that come down to gossip? And on the other hand, are there certain uses that we really should be engaging in? You know, that we, as far as it goes morally or as far as it goes with Christian obligations, we really don't have much of a choice in it. Thanks.
Next up we have, who do we have? Ilsa. Now you all saw the publicity, did everyone see it? They went all out for Veritas, etc. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of that, yeah, some people, yeah. So Ilsa was in charge of all of that, so, a little bit of clapping. Ilsa came to Oxford from South Africa to do an MA in publishing. And she's now sticking around and has been working in the world of online publishing as well as being roped into nefarious things like Veritas. So, Ilsa.
Hi, okay. let me start off by telling you a bit about myself and why I have an interesting perspective on online communities. I work as an independent publishing consultant for a non-profit organization that helps developing countries gain access to electronic academic information. I work with 50 countries in Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe, and with more than 20 publishers that are based all over the world. And what this realistically means is that I spend most of my day alone working on my computer. So when I quite recently resigned from my position, my colleagues in Armenia wrote to me saying, "While IFL is a great professional consortium, it is also a group of friends, and you will always be part of that group of friends." This made me feel very happy because I spend a lot of time working with them. However, I have never met them, and I will probably never meet them. My colleague in Sudan wrote to me saying, "On behalf of my people and my country, I would like to thank Ilsa. She was great, and she fought for us. We really appreciated her wonderful job and effort. Good luck, and may God bless you and the whole Eiffel consort and the whole Eiffel team." So these were all bittersweet words in light of our topic for Veritas this year, because I had to stop and ask myself, did I really fight for these colleagues? Would Dylan Thomas urge me to continue raging against the dying of the light? there are days that I feel so tired of talking to so many people and trying to drive a point home, when in reality I haven't seen or spoken to a single person the entire day. I think that people in our consortium have a genuine affinity for each other and will go out of their way to help each other. But at the end of the day, this is a professional consortium that is based, and their community is based and bound by professionalism and not on a personal connection. So during my days, when I want to have a chat with a friend, I can't turn to my nearest colleague and say, feel like a cup of tea. No, I turn to Facebook. And I think a lot of PhD students that work alone in the library or in their rooms will understand this. I think it's fair to say that I'm on Facebook a lot, not just because I work alone, but because I'm an international and I want to stay in touch with my friends and family back home. So as a Christian, I feel that it's necessary to look at those friendships that are facilitated by Facebook and to ask if I think that that is a model for what God taught us that friendship should be about. So when we started planning Veritas, Joel sent around a link for a Tim Keller talk called Spiritual Friendships. The one thing that struck me the most about this talk, and also related to what Graham Ward was saying, was our natural desire for friendship. God created us to live in community and friendship with each other and proclaimed at the very beginning that it's not good for man to be alone. We cannot enjoy our lives without friends, and this desire to have a deeper connection with each other is the most natural desire that God has embedded in us. However, as Aristotle wrote, the desire for friendship comes quickly, friendship does not. He also wrote about the importance of true friendship as a determinant of meaningful living. If Facebook is a tool that facilitates a lot of interaction with my friends, then how does this tool change our friendship? As Jonathan Brandt explained on Saturday at the Church and Social Media event, a tool shapes the artisan as much as he or she shapes the tool. A man can create a hammer and use that for good or for evil, but the tool shapes him when he uses it, because it shapes his muscle and it hardens the skin on his hands. In this way, Facebook changes how I see friends and our relationships. I can literally click on a button and see what it looks like. I can then compare that friendship to how other friendships look. But the thing is, can all these photos, links, funny comments, and silly poking really say, I live very far away, and I love you, and think about you every day? Or does it just delay the reality of the matter, that spending too much time apart might mean that we will change too much and no longer know each other? We create online personas that we are constantly editing. We always try to put the best foot forward. And I'm not trying to say that we cannot wear a mask in real life, but I think it's harder to fake. I've never seen someone put up pictures of a funeral on Facebook. But it's in times like these when you need your friends and family to be closest to you, and when you need the community to comfort you. All these photos of beautiful weddings and babies make me very happy on Facebook, because I can see the joy in my friends' lives. But I do not believe that that is what Christ meant when he said, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. Or, I call you friends for all things I have heard from my Father, I've made known to you. I think a part about why I share so many of my thoughts online is because I have a desire to be known by friends, for people to figure me out and love me for who I am, because this is a reflection of God's perfect love for me, the Creator that knows absolutely everything about me and whose love for me has no end. In conclusion, I believe that my desire for friendship comes from God, and I want that friendship to model how God taught us to love. It is only by embracing forgiveness that real friendships and communities can flourish. It is only then that we can really see and love each other, in spite of our flaws, and only then that we will be free enough to stop editing our online personas and really open up to one another as human beings. That is what makes Christian friendship and community unique, and why it is a true community and friendship. I am not going to stop using Facebook because it is a very useful tool. But the thing is that this year's Veritas has pushed me, and it has been a good opportunity for me to look into what Christians think about friendship and community again, and remember the values that I hold true.
Thanks, Ilsa. And our final panelist is Jonathan Kanoki, a.k.a. Juan Noche. And Jonathan is from Wisconsin. You gotta make sure I'm getting this right, okay? So, came here this year to take a break, essentially. Just, you know, ease into just doing nothing, just, you know, because he's a med student back home. So he came here this year to do an MSc in theology, because that's his idea of a holiday.
Yeah.
Go for it, Jonathan.
I feel like I was probably asked to do this in part because I'm probably the only person in this room who doesn't have Facebook, so I'm sort of representing a different position, and I want to say from
myself,
I'm very sympathetic to what Elsa said and the way that she uses Facebook. So although I'm going to be taking a more skeptical approach, I don't aim it at you in particular. So, well, I don't think that Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, and the like are intrinsically evil. I would like to take a sharper line of skepticism regarding Facebook's place in our lives than some of the speakers presented, and I'll do this by seeing it based on prudence and virtue. Part of what I will say is a limited response to people who astonishingly find out, like Ilsa, that I don't have Facebook and ask why. So to that end, I'll take up Jenny Rutherford's claim from Wednesday that Facebook or social media is just a tool and is morally neutral. I think that Graham Ward could have expounded on his rebuttal to her claim. He said, tools are created as extensions of ourselves. And as long as we realize that we are not morally neutral, then we should recognize that our creations, our tools, contain moral elements as well. And that sounds like, well, I couldn't go to the talk on Saturday that Jonathan picked up on some of that as in his talk. As I reflected on this informally, I thought about tools, their nature, what they are, and what they're for. Tools, it seems to me, are those things that aid us in accomplishing tasks more efficiently, or doing some activity more effectively, such as using a saw to cut down a tree or a fax machine to quickly transport documents. There may be other ways to define tool that we can think of, maybe disparagingly, like Joel is such a tool.
Oh, snap!
But fundamentally, tools serve as an assistant to some task we have set out to do. How should we evaluate these tools? I think we judge them in two ways. Firstly, within themselves. How well do they assist the activity to accomplish the end or goal? And secondly, within the larger context of our lives, how well do they help us to reach a life of flourishing, or eudaimonia, as Aristotle put it? The best way, then, to think about these tools in our lives is teleologically. That is, there are ends at which our activities and our life aim, which, when achieved, we consider good. To clarify, we can name certain basic human goods that our activities aim at. For instance, Oxford students read, write, revise, dialogue, and so on, for the intent of achieving the good of knowledge. That is the end. We eat as a means to maintain the good of life, and for other reasons as well. But we talk on the phone, write emails, Skype, use Facebook, all instrument or tools aimed at achieving or maintaining the good of friendship. As a tool in and of itself, how does Facebook help us to reach the good of friendship? As we've already heard on Wednesday and Saturday, and here there are myriad ways in which it keeps us in touch with various contacts, for good and ill. One aspect of Facebook, though, which stood out to me that I think often gets glossed over is its ability to conveniently share photos with others. By merely uploading our photos from the summer 8s we were just at with all of our friends we could easily access, we're able to more efficiently send these pictures rather than putting them in an email as a link. But have we ever considered how this component of Facebook has impacted physical interpersonal interaction? How would we share photos and life experiences without Facebook? A couple months ago, I was talking with a college friend from Orange County, California, about this year's Veritas Forum. He astutely pointed out, I think, that online photo albums discourage us from gathering together with friends in our community. In his neighborhood, there was a professional photographer who traveled around the world capturing pictures of surfing competitions. Upon his arrival, his return, he would gather the neighborhood kids and friends in his garage, project the photos on a screen, and share stories. We rarely do this sort of thing anymore. For myself, about 5 years ago, I was in Cambodia doing an internship for a microfinance institution. When I came back to university, I put together a photo album of meaningful places I'd been and people I'd met and shared them with friends over a Cambodian meal I prepared. But with Facebook, people flip through their pictures at their leisure in the privacy of their own homes, and maybe leave a witty comment or something pithy. But in this, there's no dynamic interaction or relation. To the larger evaluative question, how does Facebook enhance or detract from the larger end or telos of a well-lived life? And this, to me, becomes largely an issue of stewardship. Facebook takes time, and it is clearly not unique in this respect. Anything we do takes time. But we must examine our lives and reflect on how we spend our time. Am I one of the physicians who has created two separate accounts, one for personal friends and one for patients, or the person has to create two different lists of friends to determine who can see what on my page? Is this investment of my time and energy worth it? Or could I use my abilities and resources better to promote a flourishing life? It seems to me there are better ways to use my talents and my time and my abilities to build up my friendships and my community and myself. Instead of spending an hour on Facebook per day, I could use that time with friends to serve in ministry, to volunteer at a soup kitchen, a hospital, at a disability ministry, or tutor refugees. Or I could use my time to enjoy the good of aesthetics, to teach myself how to play guitar or saxophone, take dance lessons, go to an opera or a Shakespearean play, or to read classic literature or poetry or Harry Potter. I can use the time to discipline my body in order to enjoy the good of play in football, basketball, or running a marathon with friends and my dad for a charity. When I think about the whole of my life in this way, I don't see anything gained by using Facebook. Parenthetically, I would add that Facebook can take away from the discipline of our mind to be singularly focused at our work. So often I walk through the library and see people on Facebook rather than reading or writing. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German pastor and theologian, writes in his Life Together that after the morning hour of prayer, which should be spent in prayer together as a community, the Christian's day until evening belongs to work. It says in Psalm 104, "Man goes forth to his work and to his labor until the evening." Bonhoeffer continues, "Prayer is entitled to its time, but the bulk of the day belongs to work. It's not spent in idle internet surfing, BBC news reading, viewing YouTube clips, or socializing on Facebook. Each of these things, of course, has their place. But it is not the workplace. The temptation, I realize, is far greater for a community of academics who are constantly around computers and the internet in a way that the butcher, baker, and candlestick maker are not. But to work at what we do with all our heart as working for the Lord and not for men requires that we exemplify discipline of mind. In closing, I think in congruence with Jonathan's comments on Saturday, I'd like to quote Winston Churchill, who said, "First, we shape our buildings, and then they shape us." In a similar way, we create technological environments of sociability, which in turn mold us. The question should not be, what can social media do, or what can we do with social media, but instead, how will it change us? We must take full measure of social media's impact and consider not only what it does for us in an instrumental sense, but also what it may do to us as people, to our relationships, to the way our children develop, and to the way we understand ourselves. This is not to say that we should be Luddites who shun or abandon technology, but we should consider what a flourishing or eudaimonistic life looks like and how we as a Christian community should live in order to determine how much we use or do not use social media in our lives together. Thanks.
Okay, so that gives you both a huge sense of what was going on Wednesday and then Saturday, and also a whole bunch of value added into the conversation now. There's heaps I think we can discuss, and I just want to open it up generally to everyone. I noticed various things. The libertarian against the teleological conception, the fact that Jonathan's clearly a Renaissance man who can go to the gym, play sport, learn a guitar and a saxophone and I don't know whatever other goods you're talking about. So various things. So I want to anyone to just contribute. They can either ask questions, or you guys can ask questions of each other, or you can add to it, or whatever. I've got thoughts that I can add to, so if anyone's silent, then well, I'll keep blabbering. So, over to you. Ken.
Yeah, thank you, guys. That was great. Jenny's not here, so you know maybe I'm misunderstanding what she was talking about Wednesday night. But it seemed to me that she was implying in part of her presentation Wednesday that a virtual friendship can can have the same intrinsic value as one that involves human touch. And I think Graham started to contradict that a bit when he spoke about friendship as a reflection of the Imago Dei and the Trinitas, Societas, etc. And the second person of the Trinity being carnal. So I'm asking you, do you believe that it is intrinsically value equal, a virtual friendship and one that involves human touch? Or is there something slightly less human, if you will, about a virtual friendship?
Okay, so let's go to the good reverend first, because you mentioned, for instance, grooming as well. And that aspect of touch. And this is a very... So in ways, there's actually an interesting connection with Dunbar's conception of what's required for relationship is touch. This idea of incarnation and physicality of relationship as against...
This is an area I've got big internal battles on. Because I personally am a massive advocate of the fact that the body is important. I read the New Testament and think... Particularly, you know, you read 1 Corinthians and you find that Paul's saying very strongly what you do with your limbs are important because you are the limbs of Christ. The body is key. And I really think that it's interesting, sort of, Elsa, you were talking about your understanding of being alone, being that you hadn't had anyone to make a cup of tea with, you hadn't had anyone to turn to, you hadn't had anyone to hear your speech or to see anyone, even if you've been on Facebook all day. And I think there is an aspect of human physicality which is so important ideologically. However, my experience has been that I've had incredibly deep, profound moments with people online where I know there's been deep communion there, and that's actually more through the instant messaging dialogue. I've prayed with people to become Christians online. I've prayed with people who have been recently bereaved, who are not Christians, who have just needed... talk to a priest, and I've been the only priest or religious person that they've known. My experience has been otherwise, so I'm sent back to the scriptures, and I find things where, you know, a handkerchief can be blessed and then taken to a sick person, and there's some sense of the Spirit of God working through that to heal, or where Jesus can say to the centurion that your son is now healed, or daughter, I think, no, son, wasn't it? The child, servants, that was it. Sorry. Yes, exactly. It's been a long day. Yeah, the servant is now here. But the idea that somehow that there is something of God's Spirit which it transcends even the physical world, that through God's Spirit there can be a sense of communion, a sense of closeness that Jesus had with this man's servant. Through Jesus healed this man's servant personally over great distance, and I sense that there can be something through God's Spirit that enables people to be close, to be in Christian communion, even over such extreme distances. But I think one of the key things for me, practically speaking, has been this sense of dialogue. That the dialogue is so key that I don't really experience it through comments, sort of consecutive comments. It's through the instant messaging where you can butt in and where you can laugh and there is a sense of communication there, more than just sharing ideas.
So, and if anyone else wants to jump in on this as well, are you going to jump on it, John?
Yeah. I tried to limit my comments, but there was one thing there was a quote that I wrote down from Bonhoeffer that I didn't read, but it fits in very nicely with what you're talking about with the Imago Dei and physical presence. And Bonhoeffer writes that the believer praises God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit for the bodily presence of a brother. The prisoner, the sick person, the Christian in exile sees in the companionship of a fellow Christian a physical sign of the gracious presence of the triune God. Visitor and visited in loneliness recognize in each other the Christ who is present in the body. They receive and meet each other as one meets the Lord in reverence, humility, and joy.
We're just going to leave that hanging.
Well,
drop it.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that. That's the ideal.
Right.
I mean, that's what I think community and life together should be like. But of course, there are places and times where people you can't reach, and you can. I don't want to sound extreme. I think you already covered it. So, I mean, there are people that there isn't anybody around them at that particular moment. But at the same time, you have to realize that, well, you have a relation with them. Is it a friendship? And what kind of friendship is it? Is it one of the 150 in the outer circle that Professor Dunbar was talking about? Or is it one of the 15? I don't think you're going to get to the inner five that way. Of course, there's some connection.
Okay.
I have an immediate reaction to the question when I think back of some of the deep friendships that have been brought about through pen pals. Mm-hmm. Some of which have been turned into films and books, so that with people who have never met together, and yet they've become very much friends.
So that's an interesting one, and they were having a conversation in the basement of the Sheldonian before we went up about during the war when lovers, I don't know, would write to each other, husbands, wives, fiancés, whatever, write to each other, and this relationship that was just built through, like my grandparents did that obviously I think just before my granddad went off to war and wrote for 5-6 years and then got married. And then they added on to that though, of course, that when they finally got into the same room, they had to renegotiate things. It was a whole sort of change and things. But I think, yeah, that's a good... Till we replace technology with technology, in other words, a pen and paper.
But then also, when I think of the New Testament, the word become flesh, I remember Peter's writing to Christians saying, though you haven't seen him, you love him. Mm. And so none of us have seen the incarnate Lord, but we still know him and love him. Mm. And then when I think of the Bonhoeffer quote with presence of prisoners, that's true, but also it's very important today when people write to prisoners around the world and let them know that someone cares for them and thinks of them. Mm-hmm.
Or sends up an email instead of writing a letter. Either way.
There is something in the written word.
External content.
You give something of yourself, though.
Right. Joseph, start early, huh?
So John, you talked about, okay, taking time out to learn an instrument instead of going on Facebook. I want to bring in the component of personality. Sally posted a link on her Facebook wall about Carl Jung today anyway. So we talked about amplification of human nature on Facebook and online. To what extent do you think that, certain people say this is openness, this is great, libertarianism. Some people say this is detracting from personal space. To what extent do you guys think, is that a function of personality and technology, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, expanding, augmenting that?
Augmenting freedom?
No, augmenting your own personality.
So if I get practical context, Joseph is someone who works in a lab, and he and scientists generally use Twitter more than, say, I would. Would that be fair? I mean, like,
possibly.
there's a more sharing of a knowledge community or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's an extension of that person, whereas it might be it might be different.
So not just occupation, not just your
occupation,
but also your personality. Some people are extroverted, some people are introverted.
Right.
So that might govern the way you would advise people to use social networking.
Elsa, have you? No?
So I do understand John's points about that Facebook can be a giant waste of time. And that it's not always productive, and sometimes you do incredibly silly things. And then your comment of how that's like an extension of your personality, so perhaps you're just someone that enjoys reading a lot and therefore enjoy sharing that kind of information with other people, and then you can be in a dialogue together about that. And I think that that's also a valid... But I do think that we should always kind of be auditing our time in order to make sure that what you're doing is really being constructive. Just as you keep your body healthy in order to eat healthy foods and that kind of thing, you would also keep your mind healthy and watch your time as not to be, idle hands.
I think it's a question of prudence. I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong with using Twitter or Facebook for that matter. I think it's, what's the time and what are you using it for? I know that you said that you use it to post different articles or things that you're reading, so it sounds like that in that context, you're using it as a tool sort of to communicate between colleagues in your work context. I use email throughout the day, in the morning, noon, whatever. I need to have certain emails go back and forth that are, some personal, but some that are work-related. So that's something that you, I don't want to be extreme and say, oh, just shut it out, Joseph. Don't even touch it. It's of the devil. Because it's not true.
Well, actually, he is saying now that when you're writing, you have to log off.
Yeah.
It's a devil sometimes.
So I think there's a time and a place where I think it's a question of prudence. It's not something that I find intrinsically morally evil. So.
John. Well, this is interesting because, Elsie, you talked about desire to be known. And I think that can turn easily into a narcissistic tendency or something. But, yeah.
I do think that also kind of feeds into the whole constantly editing yourself online to represent a certain thing and to be seen a certain way. And I do agree that I don't think that is what God called us to be. You know, I think God told us that, you know, we're broken people, and that. But I think that Facebook is very limiting in the way that it is not. You can never accurately represent yourself as a human being or a friendship online. I think it's a great tool for communication, but I just think that would just never be possible. On the other hand, and it's also kind of the whole, you know, becoming paparazzi to your own life, where you're very kind of showy about your things, and that also kind of in your that also leads to perhaps feelings of inadequacy to other people that might perhaps. I mean, I sometimes get that if you look online and everyone else looks more interesting than you and looks more fun than you, and that is just it's not right, and that's a struggle. But am I going to start putting photos of myself on Facebook, like crying or I don't know, having a bad day? I don't know. But the thing is, I just think that it's not an accurate representation of myself. It's kind of in a way like your front garden, and you want your front garden to be neat, but it will never be a representation of myself.
I think what Facebook has now done, and newer social networks are doing, so something like Path, which limits it to 50 people, or Facebook now has algorithms that, you might have noticed this, only certain people generally pop up on your feed now. You can turn it off or on, but now I get the same people popping up. And I don't think that's actually necessarily a bad thing, because it's probably the same people. You know, Dumba was talking about four people who you're in relationship with are probably going to be the same four people who you're engaging on Facebook with, as opposed to I'm broadcasting myself to 500 people so that 500 people go, hey, look how funny Joel is or whatever. Now we're dealing with, you know, a handful of, a closer knit of people that are more likely to know I'm, as John put out, a tool. So, you know, I think that... I'm interested, though, on this point, just at what people think about Kamal's question that he raised about... And Elsa's just picked up on it as well, about putting crying up on Facebook. Or maybe one of you said about funeral pictures or something. Mm-hmm. But just even the person, this idea about how I present myself on Facebook. Should I be like, I'm just open game. Completely open game. So, one comment that Professor Ward said, and when we were having dinner beforehand, is that Augustine would talk about privacy as privitas, the exclusion of the self away from the community, away from the social. And in Augustine's conception, that is evil, to remove yourself from the people, to not be essentially entirely disclosive and entirely in relationship. This idea about, that Kamal was raising, how should you, given that you can essentially choose and construct, how should you do it? Jen?
Although I've never seen anybody post actual pictures of a funeral, I did have a friend who's, I grew up with her, I haven't spoken to her in person in, I don't know, 15 years, and her father passed away, and all of my memories of him are as a child growing up, and I found out that he passed away through Facebook, and she posted a really lovely picture, one of the last pictures of him looking healthy, passed away of cancer, And then just a stream of people, just dozens and dozens and dozens of people shared stories and memories and really lovely things to say, you know, what a great person he was and how he affected their lives. And he wasn't a Christian, so it wasn't anything in that kind of sense. But it was really nice to, and these are stories of people that I have never seen, met, heard, I know nothing about, but I was able to almost kind of have an even more, a fuller picture of Randy, and I haven't seen him in years. And although it was really sad, his daughter was able to kind of turn it around into something positive. So I don't think that Facebook has to be all happy, shiny people. I just don't. I think that it might be a reflection of just that person and that person's personality if she felt comfortable enough doing something like that and in memory of her father, but maybe the next person wouldn't.
Right.
So I don't think it's common to do that, but I do think that it can be used in that sense.
Can I jump in?
Yep, yeah. Sally, narcissism, my privitas, and Kamal's, how do we present, and so on, and yeah.
I mean, I think it is really interesting. I have to say, I do have a picture of a funeral. My first funeral I conducted is on Facebook. Not, I didn't put it up.
Yeah, first funeral!
It was interestingly, it was put up by the family. They were from a Caribbean background, actually, where I think death is much more normal to have as part of something you talk about. I think it's mostly a cultural thing, I think, that we don't put up our funerals, that we're not very good at acknowledging death and talking about it constructively. But I thought it was really interesting that they tagged me and put me up in there, as well as having a massive party around the death of this old lady. But yeah, so narcissism. I don't think it can be entirely, jumping back to Dosis's point, entirely an extrovert introvert thing. I mean, one in 13 people in the world are on Facebook, and half of that number check it every day. Which is just a mind-blowing concept, and it's growing enormously. So I don't think it can be entirely just the most extrovert people in the world. I think it does vary dramatically how you use Facebook. So some people do just use it to see the photos of their friends and family. My mum, for example. But others use it as a way of proclaiming a message. Some people use Facebook in the way that many people use Twitter, as a sort of preaching pulpit, to be able to try and cultivate. I guess my way of using Facebook, I'm one of these curators, like these museum curators that try and collect artifacts and things that I think will help people dialogue, help different groups engage together. I've got quite a wide variety of friends, and I think it's quite important, my service to the world, and actually part of my capacity as a pastor, so it is my work, is being on Facebook and enabling, trying to cultivate in the way that I would invite people over to my house to have a discussion, having a sense of hospitality, of putting stuff out there. I think there is another major distinction between people who only write things about themselves, what they have for toast that morning, what they have on their toast that morning, and people who try and promote an ideology through Facebook, who try and contribute to the lives of the other people reading it, rather than just self-expression. And I think we are moving towards a more nuanced understanding of Facebook. It's no longer just, I woke up late this morning and I got into work late and I missed my breakfast. It is that, and I think that's important, like I said. I don't think we can trivialise that entirely, because that's the stuff that we talk about to our colleagues. And I think in terms of Facebook being a waste of time, I think it's often something that the words that we say on Facebook are the words that we would say to our colleagues if we had them around. We would say, oh, hey, I read something really interesting in the papers this morning over your coffee break. But instead of just sharing it with your colleagues, you're sharing it with others around in your wider social network.
Well, I'm being a little crazy now. But we've got a whole bunch of doctoral and master's students in here. I mean, if I was to do show of hands as you're doing your work, who thinks they use Facebook as an unproductive distraction when they should be working? Like, I'm totally... Now, that could just be that we're all doctoral master's students and we inherently imbibe guilt. But yeah, okay, anyway, Giovanni.
Just a comment that, I mean, when the Berlin Wall came down, there was all these problems of fast westernization of the people who hadn't ever had a Coke before, hadn't ever had, like, a, you know, adult shop on the corner, you know, not having any concept of this, of the balance of how to use something that's so different. And I think we're experiencing that now.
Yeah.
I think you've just got to wait for, this conversation basically speeds up the process of maturation of the use. I mean, people, initially when they got phones, they would just let them ring anytime, and it seems them off. So, obviously that takes, I mean, we've only in it a few years now. We need to give it a bit more time. So,
It's more interesting, like this is one I tried raising on Wednesday, and I'm not sure it went through too well, but the idea that we can negotiate it in some ways better because we started using it, say, probably around maybe 2006 or something. Mm-hmm. Most of us would be, you know, in our 20s or, you know, whatever, starting university, whatever it was, whenever it was for you. Whereas someone who's 14, they're essentially born into Facebook or...
And you literally are. Your photo is up there within hours of your birth.
Well, who was it? The Waldemeyers, friends of some people here who created a Facebook account for their child, Susie. Anyway, Giovanni.
I think the technology will get more and more rich. And so some of these nuances, which we try and make a distinction between the two things, but if you look at it, it's the letters were... had a long time delay between them, so people put more effort into it. Essentially, we'll have a Skype with Touch very soon. Mm. So we're going to have to think, what does that mean? I don't have the feeling that there's going to be a distinction. I don't think...
Yeah.
I think basically your skills as a relator, as a person who relates, will be tested in all different ways. And I don't think... I think we need to focus on making people more skilled as relators. I mean... After that, the tools, they do shape, but they will, I mean, they do shape the interactions, but they'll change.
Yeah.
They'll become more and more like the real thing, and we have to just accept that that's going to happen. I don't think there's going to be a doubt about that. We mustn't be scared of that. It's not, I mean, like we say, anything with a real life feedback, instant messaging, Skype, we say it's a richer experience. That'll always be the case.
Right, but I guess you're right that we'll have to get used to it and so on. But I think I read recently a very, very strange article about a remote kissing machine, right? Where they were making this machine where they have people like kiss it and it would record the tongue movements and relay it to someone else.
That is so awesome!
Right? So I mean,
GCU social event after this, we're off.
So they were talking about people using it for things like having Justin Bieber do a kiss and then millions of his fans.
Oh, wow!
But these are things that will come, but they still raise questions for us as to what we will do about them, if we have any obligations about them, if we, you know, if we can use them in certain senses. And if kissing machines are coming, then we can just guess what will be a few years behind, right?
Yeah. Hand-holding machines. Jen?
Well, that's really hard to follow. what I was going to say is what I really appreciate about somebody like Sally, and very much tying into Kamal's original questions is that talking about what the limitations of Facebook and the problems of Facebook or social networking and the downsides is kind of a moot point. The reality is that the numbers that you gave are astonishing. I mean, 1 in 13 people are using it in the world and half every single day. I mean, it's not going to go away. Things like Facebook are here to stay. They're permanent. So I at least appreciate, and I don't use Facebook very often, but I do appreciate somebody like Sally that is saying, okay, well, this is here. How can I, as a Christian, utilize it to the good? And yes, you have to recognize the bad. But maybe we need to figure out how to combat that, which goes into Kamal's question, right? And I don't have an answer for his question, but what are our obligations as Christians on Facebook? And Jenny made the interesting point that almost a little scary, but that nothing is private. It doesn't matter how much we limit our options on Facebook, that once it's posted, it's there. Anybody, I mean, it exists. And I thought it was kind of interesting in the discussion that they're like, well, you know, employers are going to Facebook, and people don't want to put that they're Christian because it might prevent them from being employed by somebody if that employer knows that they're a Christian. And as a Christian, my reaction to that is, well, then that's their loss. You know, if they don't want to hire me because I'm a Christian, well, too bad for them. But at the same time, I can also see why people wouldn't want to have that. So anyways, I don't have the answers to these questions, but I think we need to at least discuss them, which obviously is what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that, for instance, like the fact that it's here means that's sort of end game or something. I mean, global capitalism is here, and slavery is here, and, you know, you could just go on and create things that are here. I mean, you're always going to have to negotiate. So, I mean, I think there's a real, I think, for me, it seems for Christians, the goal is to orientate it towards the relationship, the social, you know.
Yeah.
I like the idea, for instance, that you can think of social networking in a way of saying it's an anthropology of the person. We are defined by our relationship with people, rather than we are an individual. Which I think in Sally's talk, obviously, you get raise the tensions of you've got that, but then you've also got the libertarian aspect of it. And I think the libertarian aspect of it is a problem, because that is where you get the morally neutral idea that you can just, everyone can flourish, as opposed to, say, the teleological conception that John was talking about.
Can I jump?
Oh. Well, we'll take Kate, and then you can jump in on both.
Privitas and narcissism, I think that's been connected. So you just said that obviously thought keeping anything of yourself back is wrong.
Yeah.
It's denying yourself to the community.
Not denying yourself to the community. But when you put things on Facebook, on your profile, or when you post them, you're implicitly asking people to comment on it. It's a way of being narcissism in a way. But also, you have to take into account the burden of knowledge that you put on people when you put things out there. That I'm perfectly happy to say to anyone, good, I've had cancer, good, I've been suicidal, all sorts of things, but you're feeling very uncomfortable now. So I don't say these things just to be expressing things to the world at large, because I know it's going to weird people out.
But it would be not denying myself. So it's interesting. I mean, in a church community, we would expect that to be, we would hope as an ideal that would be a norm, that we would be disclosive in that sort of way. But yeah, you're right. Online, does that ideal transpose itself generally online?
Well, you also, I would say, if you put something like that on Facebook, you're forcing people to either respond or not respond, and
right.
then we're not sure what to be sure
right.
what they're supposed to
be. Yeah. Sally?
Well, a couple of thoughts. I think Facebook, in some senses, acknowledges that, and so does Twitter, in that they have different places you can share. So either you can share it on a wall, or you can share it in private message, or you can share it in your IM thing. So I think there is some sense of an understanding of that throughout. I think that it's, I'm just thinking how to phrase, basically I think privacy can be a bit overrated. I think we are the only, I studied anthropology before, and we're one of the few sort of sectors of the world that have as much privacy as we do. You know, it's only relatively recent history that people have had their own bedrooms that they don't share with six or seven other people that are not related to them in any way. I mean, we are hyperly private. And I think as a Christian, my aim is focusing towards this end goal that one day there will be a day when everything will be known and will be seen as it rightly is. I'm not saying that means we have to be totally honest or totally open with everyone. There has to be different levels of engagement. But I think we're not in a society that is failing to be private enough generally. I think we're in a society where there's deep loneliness, where there's deep shame from things that people are holding
back. And my experience of Facebook actually is it reinvents the parish. It reinvents this 150 people that you know pretty much everything about their lives. You know their day-to-day life in the way that the pastor knew what the backsmith was had for lunch because he walked past and saw them cooking beef. Or I mean, there is that sense of communality. And it's actually not so much Augustine, was it Augustinian stream, but the stream that comes down from the Cappadocian Fathers at the similar sort of time where they had this really strong understanding of God as Trinity, as three beings within a dance almost. And the sense that being in itself is communion, that to exist is to know yourself as in a relationship. So I exist not as an individual, but as someone's daughter, as someone's friend, as someone's colleague. I am a series of relationships, and they can be reinforced by spending time alone with my God. But I exist in that situation because I am a daughter of God. But I exist because of my communion with God and with others, if that makes sense.
Should I comment to that? Sorry. I don't think that we should blur the lines between online community and Christian community because those things are not the same thing. I don't think that you should trust everyone online. I don't think that you should necessarily splurge out all your personal and parts of you that hurt most to absolutely everyone in the entire world. I do believe that as Christians we are committed to share each other, to share ourselves with each other as we weekly do, as we are called into community, as we meet, with your small group or whatever, where you are called to share your life and to share your struggles and also to share your joys and then the mutual empathy through prayer. But I do believe that there is a different level of commitment, and I think that that is also something that we kind of got about social media, that there is a different level of commitment. You know, you sharing something very personal online, like, you know, I feel very depressed. You know, someone could just comment on that. You know, minimum cost, minimum time. Oh, I hope you feel better. But the thing is, in reality, it's only through true community and through people that have actually known you and actually love you, that those are the people that will actually be with you in the end. And the thing is, that's why I do think that there is a very real difference between these two communities. And it's probably the people, like the inner five, or, you know, your very close-knit, strong community that will be there for you online as well as somewhere else. So I wouldn't want to blur those lines, and all of a sudden you have to be open to absolutely everyone in the entire world, or you are being sinful.
Briefly, is that right?
Yeah, I think we'll unless there's something burning after this, we'll close up after okay. Final comments from.
I was wondering, maybe this is sort of rhetorical, but. I was thinking about the different components of Facebook, about like profiles and, you know, messaging and photo albums, and that there are certain things.
How do you know so much about it if you're not even on it?
My sister's on
it. You just look over the shoulder. Sorry.
No, but I guess part of the question I was thinking about was how does the fact that we have a profile picture or a profile with all this information about us change, for lack of a better word, organic nature of getting to know people. You might meet somebody at some gathering, and then all of a sudden you go home and you friend them, and then everything you could want to know about where they're from and their friends and their interests, it's like, it's all there. It's all right there. And then I can put them in, like, oh, okay, I know what kind they are. I can put them in a box. Maybe, maybe not. On one hand, it could foster conversation later, be like, oh, I see you're interested in, you know, this thing, and I'm interested in that same artist. Let's go to a concert together. Yeah, that's really great. I think part of the thing I've learned this year is, not to put people in an intellectual box. Like, I can't have a conversation with somebody studying philosophy or theology and be like, oh, you're in that one. I need to get to know them as they are and enjoy the sort of mystery and the process of unraveling the onion and get to know them. And I wonder if sometimes if Facebook and the profile pictures when you first meet people takes some of that away. But I don't know. I think it could go either way. But.
Well, have you got any last words?
Not really, but.
All right. I think that's a good way to finish, unless you want to say more.
Just tweet us.
All right, just quickly. I think it's interesting what Sally said about Facebook reinventing the parish, you know. And I guess, I don't know, I'm a bit skeptical about that, because part of the thing of living in a small community, and I'm from a small community where everyone knows your business, is that they're
very few people to know the business of, right? So I could know everyone's business here. If I have 1,000 friends on Facebook and I know all of their business, I just can't keep track of it, and it just becomes dangerous in a sense. And just respond to John, I guess, Jonathan. Yeah, that's probably a good point, but the way I take it with profile information like that, I mean, I've had cases like that where someone come up and say, oh, I see you're a very religious person. Like, how do you know that? And I guess it's from Facebook or something, but it depends on how you take it. If I see someone likes, I don't know, something that I like, then you can take it, you can see these things and try to build a picture of the person and you say, oh, he likes Lady Gaga and Game of Thrones, but he also has a quotation from the Bible and so on. You try to guess.
This is a self-description?
You're like, Lady Gaga. No, that's Joseph. Lady Gaga.
That's me.
Yeah, so.
Start early.
Or you could say, that's an interesting person. I'd like to see how these things mesh together in a person, because I didn't see how I could mesh together in me. I don't know.
Joe, this is a mystery.
I'm going to bring it to a closing unless someone hasn't had an opportunity to say something they really would like to. There's more that can be discussed. I, for instance, I'm always interested in Wikipedia and its understanding of education, but anyway. That's us. That's basically us for Veritas this year, really, in the official sense. I want to thank, I know there's a couple of other people in this room, so I want to thank, first of all, if you can join me in thanking all these guys. especially Sally, who's, come up from London, not